Good morning. We are so fortunate today to have Leilani Frew, who's the Deputy Secretary of Financial and Commercial at New Zealand Treasury. Those of us in Australia will know Leilani of old, actually, from some of the significant leadership she's done on projects in New South Wales and in Australia. Welcome so much to Inside Infrastructure.
Thank you. Pleased to be here.
If we can start with just a little bit about you. I think lots of people in the infrastructure sector in Australia, New Zealand would have seen you for many years, but not known very much about your own story. Where did you grow up and how did that start your and inform your career trajectory today?
Interesting. So I am a child of a tiger mum. So Malaysian Chinese background is my mother, who married a New Zealander, you know, with my father being Cook Island Maori. They met in New Zealand, and I was born in Singapore on the New Zealand Army base. Mm. So by background, I guess I'm a Maori, Cook Island Maori, Malaysian Chinese New Zealander. However, you know, I grew up in Brisbane, even though I started school in New Zealand, but I grew up in Brisbane, did a lot of my secondary school there, my university there, so feel largely connected to Queensland. I married a Queenslander, third generation Queenslander, and spent a lot of my time up there, and then moved with my husband to Sydney in about 2000, and we are proud parents of a now 19-year-old boy who's a New South Welshman.
So, I mean, the core question then is, who do you support in the race?
New Zealand.
And do you have a Queensland Reds as well? Or?
No, I'm a Crusaders fan. Wow. But, yes. But I support the Brisbane Lions in AFL.
Who does your son support in the rugby?
So he supported the Wallabies for a number of years and then is now a New Zealander supporter.
What was the transition to do with the performance?
Perhaps, but it may also have been to do with a deal with my husband that we agreed that for a certain period of his life, he could be a Wallabies supporter, but his heart belonged to New Zealand.
I took a completely different set of questions out of that. I was thinking, what food heritage? My mother is also Chinese Malay and, you know, just, I mean, it's a very mixed multicultural type of heritage. So have you spent much time travelling around into those various communities? Is that a part of your cultural upbringing?
Yeah, absolutely. My mother was very, very, you know, keen to ensure we stayed connected culturally in terms of food and family. As you would know, you know, family is quite important in those types of cultures and communities. Also having a Polynesian background, it's a very similar kind of approach. Community and family are very central. So absolutely, you know, anything to do with food is something that's quite central in our family.
Okay. So you hadn't really spent much time in New Zealand until your most recent career?
Not professionally, that's correct. So mainly travel, going and seeing family, because my father's side of the family is still largely in New Zealand, and travel with my own family as well. Yeah, but not professionally, apart from in sort of like the early 2000s when there was a little bit of privatisation that happened over there. So when I was working in banking here, we did a lot of support and private project financing over there.
Yeah. So talk us through that early career and how you got into the world of banking and infrastructure.
Yeah, it's an interesting journey. So I'm engineering trained.
You're an engineer.
I have a piece of paper that says that I have a mechanical engineering degree.
I did not know that.
That was my first degree. But sort of saw a different light quite early on in my career. I spent time up in Mount Isa Mines and learnt very quickly that engineering was not necessarily for me.
Oh, so you did actually practice as an engineer?
I wouldn't say actually practiced. It was a very short stint up in Mount Isa,
right.
But it sort of opened my eyes to an environment for a young female engineer in a mining town in North Queensland that was not at that time, you know, and a conducive environment to wanting me to, or enabling me to, or encouraging me to stay in that profession for the rest of my career. Mm. So after that, I decided to come back to Brisbane. And the only thing that I knew at the time was study. So I went and enrolled in a business degree and did banking and finance and accounting, because that's what you kind of did when you were doing a business degree back then, and decided that I really liked the finance world. And actually, that was my first step into public service when I went and joined QTC back in the mid-90s.
Phew.
And at QTC, I had a great time. I was working in the back office and got the chance to be seconded up to Queensland Treasury, where I got exposure to budget and state finances and state fiscal positions, and actually really got exposure at that point to what it means from being in a central treasury to your funding decisions that you make and how they impact on the ground. So part of Treasury's outreach was to go and send Treasury people out into the regions of Queensland. And at the time, Queensland Treasury had just updated what they call the Statutory Bodies Financial Act or something like that. And we went out to Longreach to go and talk about the changes of the Act and what that might mean. And interestingly, we went and visited the local fire service. And talking to the people on the ground, they talked about the impact of the decisions that were being made centrally in Brisbane around their funding. And something that sort of resonates with me is that along the wall, they had all of their fire safety equipment, boots and jackets and pants, etc. And there were a few hooks that were empty. And one of the comments that one of the people on the ground there made to me was that the impact of a decision in Treasury to cut their funding meant that some of their firefighters went into battling fires and bushfires and house fires, etc., in Longreach without full protective equipment. And so that's something that resonated with me quite early in my career in public service, was the power of your decisions and what they actually mean for people on the ground. So after coming back from Queensland Treasury, I went back to QTC and found myself fortunately in the policy and advisory area. And at that time, the QTC was doing a project financing for the Mica Creek Power Station that was owned 50% by CS Energy. And that's when I realised that this is what I wanted to do for the rest of my life.
So what was it?
It was the mix of engineering and financing in the world of big infrastructure, and at the time a big power station. And so I had a fantastic boss called Peter Gallagher, who said, if you want to do this, you have to move to Sydney or Melbourne, because that's where the banks are and that's where their project finance teams are. So I saw an ad in the paper for the Commonwealth Bank, applied for it, flew down here for a few interviews, and was successful. And so that sort of started the move to Sydney and started my career into the sort of private sector world of financing. And I spent time at the Commonwealth Bank doing project financing for energy assets, utilities. They were really quite big in the early 2000s, because that was where all the activity was happening, with either the US organisations coming in, the European organisations coming in, the US going out, the Europeans going out. And so there was a lot of activity in that space.
Would have been the generators at that?
Gas pipelines,
right.
A number of the is sort of the tail end of the privatisations in Queensland, in Victoria, and in the sort of generation space, some of the utility space and downstream space.
And the Anna Bligh privatisations in the...
So that came a little bit later. Yeah, that came a little bit later. That's right. So that was probably... later in the 2000s that occurred. Right. So, yeah, I spent time doing that, oil and gas as well, project finances, when coal seam gas sort of started to become quite a prospective industry for Australia. You know, first coal seam gas project out in Camden was half owned by AGL, so it did some work in Commonwealth Bank and sort of project financing that. And that was probably one of the first project financings of coal seam gas that occurred in Australia at the time. And then, you know, as all banks do. They restructured, and in a restructure, opportunities come about, and I got the opportunity to move from the debt side to the equity side. So I don't know if you know the history, but Commonwealth Bank was probably one of the first banks to put equity interests into infrastructure assets. Mm-hmm. So in the late 90s, when the privatisations of the Victorian generation assets, Commonwealth Bank actually had an equity stake in Hazelwood Power Station. And they had a team that would go around putting equity, Commonwealth Bank equity, into infrastructure assets. So they had stakes in Loy Yang A, Bankstown Airport. At the time that I moved into that group, they were looking at UK PFIs, so hospitals in the UK, and then they eventually went on to toll roads in Europe, etc. as well. And that was like a precursor to a lot of the infrastructure funds that ended up, you know, Macquarie dominating, Babcock and Brown dominating, and then, you know, moving on from that. And it was quite a sort of progressive thing for, I think, an Australian bank to do. Mm. And so I had, you know, the benefit of being able to sort of structure equity, invest in equity, sit on boards to manage those unlisted equity investments at the time. But a lot of it was still quite in the energy space and quite a reformative energy period because that's when the renewable energy targets came in to promote investment in renewable energy, you know, sort of another sign of when government tries to intervene to create markets and bring forward development and get investment happening in a new sector. And that's kind of the sort of benefit that I had at that time of being able to work in that space and finance into that space. And for a long time and an enjoyable time at CBA, it was a great period. I just did a lot of skills acquisition, debt, equity, you know, shareholding, governance, and then was asked by ABN AMRO to come and join their M&A team in their power and utilities team. Mm. And that was around 2007, yeah. And
interesting timing.
It was very interesting timing because, as you know, ultimately ABN AMRO got taken out by RBS, and it was a very sort of tumultuous time for, you know, banking more globally. But still, in Australia, quite a lot of activity was still happening. You know, ABN AMRO was a key advisor to people like AGL, who did a lot of work in the greenfield coal and gas space, you know, did a lot of acquisitions of pipelines and sale of their stakes and assets, of like generation assets, etc. So did a lot of work on that space, equity raisings for Arrow Energy, ERM, IPOs. So there was a lot of, again, skills acquisition that was, from my personal perspective, that was occurring during that period in investment banking. And there was, as part of ABN AMRO / RBS, that we jointly bid with Rothschild and Merrill Lynch at the time to help the Queensland government with that round of privatisations under NBLI.
Yeah, okay. So Port of Brisbane?
Or? Port of Brisbane, the toll roads, the forest assets, and a restructure of Queensland Rail.
Yeah, okay. And then after that, New South Wales Treasury. Is it?
Not quite. I did stop for a little. I moved from RBS for a short period of time to a company called Moelis, that's now called MA Financial, which at that time of banking in Australia, there was a lot of, I guess, very senior bankers that were leaving the big institutions and creating boutique. And so this was a boutique that had been established by Andrew Pridham. He'd moved out of UBS with a couple of other colleagues and moved into JP Morgan and then moved and created Moelis. Mm. And at the time, they were big in the small and medium caps, had an equity platform, and were looking to grow opportunities in the infrastructure space. So I took an opportunity to go and work with them for a couple of years. They were really strong here, and they still are, I should say. They were really strong in property as well as the restructuring space. So 2010-ish, you know, there was still a lot of fallout from the global financial crisis, and so there was a lot of restructuring activity happening around the world. Moelis was quite strong here, and one of the interesting opportunities I got was to support two of Moelis's New York-based clients. They were credit wrappers called Fidjik and Syncora, who had wrapped the debt for the Reliance Rail PPP.
Okay.
And so that was sort of, I guess, the precursor into moving into New South Wales government, because it was only a couple of weeks or a few weeks into the change of government in New South Wales that myself and my colleagues at Moelis, as well as St. Cor and Fidjik, were in front of, at the time, Mark Baird as the Treasurer and Gladys Berejiklian as the Transport Minister, talking about Reliance Rail and the need to restructure it.
Yeah.
And that led to about an 18-month negotiation between all of the parties involved, but, you know, led a lot by my clients and the New South Wales government.
And Peter Regan was in Treasury.
Right. So it was the first time I met Peter Regan, and he was the main person that we negotiated with. Yeah.
Mm. Great. Can I ask, like, going back to your original depiction of leaving Mount Isa in an environment that wasn't conducive or well set up for young women, and you've then moved into finance and infrastructure, which is also quite a male-dominated industry, but a lot of your work in the sector has actually been about mentoring women, et cetera. So what have you seen as driving your own career through those different changes in each of those, between, you know, RBS to Moelis, et cetera? Were you looking to just drive your skills? Were you finding mentors along the way? What connected you into each of your successive opportunities?
I guess I probably should admit that for a long time I never accepted that being a woman was going to necessarily be an obstacle for anything that I wanted to do. Comes down to the fact that I was brought up by a very strong mother who instilled in me a sense of independence and a sense of there's nothing that you cannot do, to embrace difficult and complicated and to walk towards challenge. So that's sort of the learnings I took from my mother. And so that's probably some things that have grounded me in all of the things that I've ever had the benefit or opportunity to do in my career. As I said, you know, I've just been really fortunate that a lot of my career opportunities have come from change and walking into change and embracing change. So, as I said, I just, you know, got the opportunity to do a secondment up into Queensland Treasury and jumped at it. Okay. Came back to QTC and got asked to do a different role and jumped at it. And so I just, you know, I'm very comfortable with walking into something that I may not know a lot about and confident that I can get there and I'm, you know, can learn along the way. And then expressing, as I said, an interest in a particular world and taking people's advice to go and have a go at it. Look, I have benefited from a number of people who have taken the chance on me as well, you know. So for QTC to bring someone into the financial services, into the back office, who only had an engineering degree and was halfway through a business degree, that was a leap of faith by my manager at the time to employ me. For Commonwealth Bank to take that same leap of faith and say, yep, you know, fantastic, you've only got an engineering degree, halfway through at the time a master's in finance degree, haven't done anything in project finance, have a go. And then I've just taken the opportunities when they have come in front of me. You know, at the time, well, there was one time when I was at Commonwealth Bank. We had a deal where we had to negotiate a project financing for a client in WA. I was very new in that world. My boss couldn't go at the time, so sent me over, and I was sitting in the negotiations and they were talking about terms that I wasn't really familiar with. And I remember saying I needed to go and have a break. I'd ring my boss and say, can you please explain to me what this term is? And he would tell me, and then I'd go back in and look very confident and agree or disagree with whatever the client was proposing. So I sort of found ways to, I guess, fake it until I made it, if that makes sense.
And people gave you the room to learn on the job.
Yeah, and gave me the space. Similarly, when I moved from the Commonwealth Bank into ABN AMRO, same. I'd never been in investment banking. I'd never done M&A in that sort of way. I'd always been on the financing side of it, but not at the front end of it. Was given a leap of faith to do that from. So I've always been fortunate to do that. And then similarly, the move into public service in 2013, conversation with Peter. He was looking for people with particular skills and experience. And I said to him, who are you looking for? Maybe I know some people. And he said, would you be interested? And I said, well, actually, I did ask him how much he paid for this. That was my first question. And then after the weekend of thinking about that, I thought, wow, this is a great opportunity to be involved in something fantastic.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to dive down a bit into that opportunity, because mm-hmm. we look back now at that kind of 2012, 2013 and the kind of 10 years that followed us, perhaps the halcyon days where we had balance sheet reform resulting
in
what was termed asset recycling, reinvestment in infrastructure, some really big transactions mm-hmm. that came through. Was that part of the pitch to you, that that was the journey that you'd be on?
Yes and no. So I tend to look for opportunities, I tend to measure opportunities based on a few factors. Absolutely. Have I got anything that can actually add value? Because we want to spend our days doing things that we're actually satisfied and we feel we're adding value to. The experience of negotiating with or against the New South Wales government, Peter Regan, and seeing the operations of Mike Baird and Gladys Berejiklian at the time gave me a really good sense of the types of people that I'll be working for. I think at the time it was really clear from Peter's and Tim Spencer's vision for Treasury that what they needed and what they accepted was good commercial capability into Treasury. And I thought that was really quite refreshing to see someone who understood that skills and capability are just as important as things to get outcomes for people. And so, you know, the cultural environment was a real attraction to me, and the fact that the government had a plan. And it had a multi-year plan, which is, as you know, was really important in infrastructure. I mean, multi-generational assets take multi-terms of government to actually start and get in place and deliver.
And a plan for paying for it as well.
Correct.
It wasn't just a list of wishes. It was a way of paying for those.
And the strong level of commitment. And so that was very obvious from the beginning, and it as it's turned out, it's what came to pass, you know, with many challenges to, I think, that level of commitment, but it still came to pass.
Presumably at that stage it was broad brushstrokes of a plan. The detail was filled in subsequently.
Well, remember, I joined New South Wales government in 2013, so they'd already been in government for a couple of years. And so they had already started to put the fundamentals in place.
And it was the 2015 election they took polls and wires.
That's right. That's right. So by the time I joined, they'd already done a couple of, they'd outlined their fiscal strategy. They talked about, you know, preserving the AAA. Mm-hmm. They had already done a couple of privatisations or long-term leases. That's right. And so they sort of had a good fiscal discipline in place, and it seemed from my perspective to be the right balance. You know, I think sometimes we either go too far on the expenditure or too far on the fiscal restraint. You have to find the right balance, particularly in our space. They'd set up Infrastructure New South Wales. Mm-hmm. So they had a real sense of, we need long-term planning, we need long-term strategies. Gladys Berejiklian's long-term transport master plan is infamous, and so, you know, that was in place. So it was really quite obvious that they were getting the foundations right, as well as bringing in the capability to execute on the plan. At the time that I came in, it wasn't public that Poles and Wires were going to be an election platform, or that Mike Baird, as Treasurer, had this plan to look at privatising those assets or long-term leasing those assets for the benefit of investing in more infrastructure. It obviously came a bit more obvious over the next couple of years that I was there, but, again, just another example for me being in the system of how they were committed to ensuring the right outcomes were going to be delivered.
You've distilled there a few of the really critical elements linked to getting a sustained infrastructure pipeline. In moving to New Zealand, has that been part of your remit to set up some of that structuring within government for a similar sort of program?
Yeah, so when I was contacted by Carolyn McLeish, who was the Secretary of the Treasury at the time. And she sort of rattled off a couple of things which then made it very familiar. You know, under the previous Labor government, there was the establishment of the Infrastructure Commission, who had identified that there was a significant deficit in terms of infrastructure expenditure. I think at the time it was around about $130 billion or something like that, that they were looking at how could they make a dent in that. They needed some commercial and financial capability to come and assist. Whilst they'd had a program of PPPs under the previous government, it had ceased for a while, that they just had a need to reset the entire system in New Zealand to be able to deliver on what was at the time quite an ambitious infrastructure agenda. And would I be prepared to come and help? And so again, something complex, something challenging, and the opportunity to go back and work in New Zealand, which I feel is very close to my heart, was something that I couldn't say no to. Certainly, it was a bit of deja vu because it felt a little bit like the same kind of environment that was here in New South Wales in 2011. And so, but interestingly, the opportunity to learn of all the great work that happened in not just New South Wales, but in Victoria and broader Australia over the sort of 10 years prior. So yes, in a way, it was part of the opportunity to help strengthen that system. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what's been the focus of your time in New Zealand in terms of projects? Is it a similar remit to what you're doing in New South Wales in terms of the funding and financing of major projects?
Well, yes and no. I'd probably say that I went there 4 years ago with part of my role to focus on how should we set New Zealand up for success in the infrastructure investment space. Still in the sort of throes of COVID, and then we had a significant weather event which sort of probably disrupted the ability to make that happen faster. But a lot of the change has kind of really consolidated with the change of government. The new government has come in 18 months ago, similarly, you know, wanting to address the infrastructure deficit and to get investment back into New Zealand, not just in infrastructure but more broadly. They're embracing the role of private capital in that space. They recognise the challenges and the global sort of competition that New Zealand has for resources and for good capability across the life cycle of infrastructure.
And then the investment echoes to New South Wales for 2011 are quite striking to me.
Right, correct. The difference is that there were some quite marked differences in the sort of institutional structure and the system in New Zealand. You know, at the high level, the public and private sector are a little bit more distant than in Australia. And we even talk about sometimes in Australia, it's not as close as it could be or as close as we see in other jurisdictions like the US. Mm. And what I mean by that is that the movement between private and public sector of people and employees is not as fluid, but also the engagement approach between public and private sector. And I think, you know, in Australia, we've had many years now of different jurisdictions, albeit at different times, doing PPP type transactions, which encourage interaction and engagement. And so therefore, those types of ways of working are very common.
I say also certain bodies that bring together public and
private infrastructure. Correct. Absolutely right. And I think IPA is a really unique example of even your advisory board has public and private sector members on your advisory board. It's not something that I've seen replicated anywhere. And I think that enables, it's like engagement at all levels, right? And the respect that people can still be on different sides of different tables and still be able to engage in a way that still holds integrity is something I think which, you know, IPA does a great job at promoting and enabling.
I'm happy to chop that bit of, you know, big each part. Maybe we'll keep it. Yeah. We have skipped over a couple of things and we'll come back to New Zealand in a minute, but I do want to talk about a couple of the really big transactions in New South Wales.
Yeah.
I don't know if you want to choose them, but certainly Poles and Wires and then perhaps some of the Sydney Metro or West Connects, like the really, really big things that you would have been involved with and kind of how they changed the game a bit.
What are the learnings?
What was good? What was bad? What was ugly?
Yeah.
So I can't talk directly about the Poles and Wires because I didn't work when I was in New South Wales Treasury. I didn't work on the privatisation directly, but I can talk about what some of the ingredients were that made it successful, but also what it enabled, really. You know, so I think, as I said before, what I feel the New South Wales government under Barry O'Farrell and under Mike Baird and then under Gladys Berejiklian did was they had a multi-term vision for what they wanted to do in terms of, you know, fixing the books, earning more than you spend, and investing in infrastructure for intergenerations. And they were consistent regardless of when the premiers changed. You know, they were consistent in rolling that out and staying true to the course, and that was a level of alignment that I hadn't really kind of experienced before. The second thing was that doing that in a fiscally disciplined way and being conscious that you have as a government you have multitude of tools.
Yeah.
It wasn't just all about tax and it wasn't just all about slashing expenditure, that there was this tool called the balance sheet that was that should be used and could be used to support that investment. And interesting, the way they thought about the balance sheet in a very active way, that it wasn't just about assets we can sell, but liabilities that we can reduce, and risks that if we don't manage this balance sheet, will create liabilities or take away value from our assets.
Yeah.
So that real active balance sheet thinking in the way they thought about fiscal strategy and how they then unlocked it and unleashed it was, you know, really quite amazing to watch and think about, and probably quite holistic, I think, in terms of what the role of the fiscal strategy or the balance sheet was not about just managing the balance sheet, but it was enabling investment and growth for New South Wales, and so how they connected that. And so how that comes back for me to the Poles and Wires was that they recognised that they had an asset that had value and that there wasn't necessarily a strong rationale or purpose for maintaining it in public ownership, and that if it could be monetised, it could, you know, create a source of funding for investment in a environment where investment was direly needed, yeah. But what was quite interesting was that they also realised that just knowing it themselves wasn't enough.
Hmm.
You know, they needed to, I guess, sell it to the public. They needed to bring businesses along with them as well. And they sort of created what we now all call the asset recycling playbook, you know, what people will get from enabling the release of an asset that they feel quite connected to. And I thought that was pretty amazing how they connected right down to actually what do people get out of this? What do citizens get out of enabling us to release this asset and what we invest in?
It was an act of securing social license, wasn't it?
Yeah.
State infrastructure strategy at that time basically said, if we recycle this set of assets, we can invest in metro and cultural infrastructure, sport infrastructure, etc.
Yeah. Well, the state infrastructure strategy gave them the ability to communicate to New South Wales citizens what could be possible to benefit from in the future, right?
So, completely agree with you. So it made it about the thing you're buying, not the thing you're selling.
That's right.
The problem it comes up against is one of time, which is that the thing you're buying takes a long time.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's only in the last few months Sydney has got the sort of really visible fruits of that labour in Metro opening and WestConnex opening. I wonder to what extent that the continual making of that argument that we got this because we sold that has probably not happened as much as it that should, is just reminding people that it is balance sheet reform. It's why they have a shiny metro and a roads opening every 6 months. Now,
yes, I think so. If you need to do that, I don't think we need to do that any. You know, I think the rationale of selling what you might get out of it was a sort of strategy that enabled the sale of the poles and wires. Mm-hmm. On the basis that people would have faith that they would get something, and they kind of have got something now, but I don't think they need to be reminded that you've got this because you sold something.
I guess my point
is maybe if there's a desire by future governments to then recycle future things,
yeah,
then that is where they sit there and they remind. Remember, in 2015, you enabled the government of the day to, you know, recycle the poles and wires, and you got WestConnex and you got light rail and you got, you know, hospitals and the regions and schools and all those sorts of things.
There was another job between New South Wales and New Zealand.
Oh, that's so right.
Federal Treasury, yes. And the Infrastructure Project Finance Agency. Talk us through that would have at that time been your third Treasury, and now you've got four?
My second Treasury.
It is Convent in Queensland.
Oh, that's right. Sorry, I forgot about that one. That's right. Yes, that's right.
Third Treasury at the time.
Yes, third Treasury at the time. So I think that was similar. I mean, as you recall, Adrian, the then federal government also decided it wanted to ensure that it was making some, you know, big investments in infrastructure. I think at the time they were planning on doing about $100 billion over 10 years investment in infrastructure, and similarly recognised that they needed certain type of capability in the Commonwealth. And the plan at the time was to set up a agency that had dedicated commercial and financial capability. And it was very interesting that the construct of it was to be a standalone agency rather than just a unit in a department, or the unit department of finance, for example. And I do think part of the reason for that was a concern that perhaps if it was just a part of a department, that perhaps it wouldn't be able to have the impact at pace that the government of the day were looking for. And so whilst we at the time did have to, we had direct reporting into ministers, we had to produce annual reports and all of those normal things that you would have as a standalone agency, which seemed a bit unusual for what was largely a advisory unit or expertise into the departments. I think it made sense because it had that chance to sort of establish itself and to establish its value for the system and operate, across the system without getting departmentized or, bureaucraticized out of impact and value. So it was a good, interesting time. It was sort of, I think it's been about 3 years as the CEO there, just bringing in capability and working across government, but was very much focused, very similarly like we had in New South Wales and in the infrastructure and structured finance unit, on bringing that capability for the benefit of departments who were the principals for the funding or the commercial arrangements or the agreements that they were striking with the states or on their own in terms of the stuff that the Commonwealth was responsible for itself.
Do you think it lived up to the expectation? I know it was sort of subsumed back into Treasury, but do you think it achieved the original aims? I think it was Prime Minister Turnbull.
That's correct.
At the time, did it achieve the aims he wanted it to, or did it morph into something else?
So I think that it achieved the need to just uplift the capability of the Commonwealth and to enable the conversations between the Commonwealth and the state, and the Commonwealth and some of the SOEs and some of the SOEs or the Commonwealth SOEs and their counterparties to a sort of joint level of sophistication and expertise, I think. As we know, I think when we get great outcomes between private sector and public sector engagement, it's where the capability on both sides is very equal. Mm-hmm. And that can lead to better outcomes, better engagement, better contracting, better arrangements. Certainly, it had a sort of period where education needed to occur, you know, so what actually could be done by the Commonwealth in its role, whether equity was actually a right sort of tool for the Commonwealth to use in particular circumstances, or debt, or whether just, you know, better funding agreements between the Commonwealth and the state. So we had a bit of an education pathway. But like during that period, it really went through and identified what of the Commonwealth investments actually could be attractive for private investment, what type of investments by the Commonwealth should be structured in a different way that enabled taxpayer money to be recycled and brought back and redeployed back out to other parts of the nation. Mm. So I can't remember. I think we did probably about 230 pieces of advice on about, you know, can't remember how many billions of dollars of project. And I think only now, as you say, it takes a while for some of those to come to fruition. I think some of the outcomes that have occurred on intermodal and some of the other early pieces of advice that set up some of the eventual funding arrangements has come to pass.
Mm.
I think you mentioned before, you know, it got eventually subsumed back into Treasury. I mean, it did follow Stephen Kennedy wherever he went. So he went from Prime Minister and Cabinet to the Infrastructure Department and then to Treasury. It is, if you look at where that capability sits generally in governments and many jurisdictions, it sits in treasuries or finance departments, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think it was always going to be natural that the capability, once it established, the Commonwealth saw and realised what it was and how it could add value, it was right that it should be. They've become part of the DNA and the ecosystem of you know, the treasury, the Commonwealth treasury and or finance.
So if I was just to trace some themes across your four treasuries.
Mm-hmm.
So you've done two states, two national.
Yep.
But the New Zealand national is to some extent more like the states in that it is responsible for the bulk of delivery of infrastructure, or certainly the kind of major infrastructure. I know the local governments.
Yeah, I guess it's very similar to the UK model.
Yeah.
Right, where you do have, yes, a bit more of the service delivery responsibilities in certain sectors responsible for the national the responsibility of the national government.
Mm.
Health, education are some examples, but also where you've got local governments who are big service delivery providers as well. Transport is a sort of, you know, natural example that comes to mind, which also then means that the assets are owned by the Crown and by the local councils.
Mm.
And so the ecosystem's a little bit more complicated in respect of stakeholders and parties that need to align to get things done.
I mean, the other similarity to the UK is also the level of government that raises revenue and has responsibility for the large licks of expenditure, whereas, of course, the states here have limited revenue.
That's
some responsibility, and the feds have...
That's right.
Obviously less.
That's right. That's right.
Delivery. So in a way, I mean, I guess the argument I'm making is New Zealand's a useful one for you to come at the end of those four treasuries, because the others do composite parts of what
correct
New Zealand does.
Correct. And so you can see, like, I think, you know, the Crown is a big, in New Zealand, the Crown is a big, as you say, revenue raiser, but also a big funder of local government activities.
Mm.
And so what kind of has occurred over many years is that it hasn't really been a contested environment for that. The Crown would just be just provides money to local governments.
Yeah.
Mm. And some of it's legislated to be unlimited and without sort of a lot of rigour around some of it, you know.
Mm.
Particularly in disasters, there's just an open checkbook for the Crown to provide 60% up to 60% or 70% of, you know, disaster funding to local governments for infrastructure recovery and rehabilitation. So it has definitely that sort of safety net element, but, you know, I think can also benefit from some strengthening and discipline around, you know, how, particularly in this environment where they want to really increase the level of investment and they want to make sure they're making the right decisions for the investment, there's a real opportunity to just strengthen the discipline of how money gets allocated, as well as in an environment where you've got a bit more fiscal tightening of the just, you know, purse strings more generally. Yeah.
So if you took a So bring you back to today and what you're trying to do in New Zealand. If there was a grab bag of things you could pick from those different jurisdictions within the context room, what things would you take and say, well, having that's good?
So I guess we've already taken some things. The last 18 months, as I said, you know, the new government came in and that really gave the chance to really accelerate getting the fundamentals right. And they've spent the last 12 to 18 months just trying to get the fundamentals right. So as I reflect on New South Wales planning, you know, the Infrastructure Commission developed an infrastructure strategy 7 years ago or 5 years ago. The fast follow in terms of the National Infrastructure Pipeline is just getting its momentum now. It is probably something that has been needed for, you know, would have been great to have it a couple of years ago, but certainly having a national infrastructure plan is something that, you know, is a foundational block that I think is really quite needed in New Zealand. So it's good to see that by the end of the year, they're planning to have that, the inaugural one finished or presented to government. Policies and processes, as I said before, enabling private capital or PPPs in New Zealand was put a little bit on hold from about 2012 to 2017 onwards or something. And so they haven't had the benefit to evolve the PPP policy, risk transfer, all of the learnings that everyone, the rest of the world, including Australia, has had the benefit of for the last 15 years. So, again, Infracom put out a blueprint document which highlighted all of the things that need to be done to improve that policy to enable private capital in the infrastructure, greenfield infrastructure space. So that needs to be converted into tangible policies and tangible contractual change, which is occurring over the next few months. Asset management plans, as we know, infrastructure deficits are both new and existing asset condition. So a lot of the infrastructure deficit in New Zealand is due to lack of looking after our own assets. For the first time, we're actually getting 10-year asset management plans from agencies being developed, and that's only occurred last financial year. Ways to go, as you can imagine, different levels of sophistication and detail and quality in those, but that's needed as well to enable what is it we actually need to invest in and why.
And so that's actually actively driving investment.
Well, it's actively driving an understanding of what's needed. Yeah. So the National Infrastructure Plan, asset management plans, we have now also got a number of what I would call the sector infrastructure strategies or capability plans or infrastructure investment plans, with the latest one, I think, that the health minister announced maybe a couple of weeks ago, the health infrastructure investment plan. So that's in a 10-year outlook of what is needed in the health space in terms of investment and in infrastructure. So we've actually started to get the what is needed, where and when in place. Now, that hasn't been a situation that New Zealand's been in for a long time, and I would probably argue nearly ever. Then you've got needing to sort of strengthen the system. You know, there's been a lot of reporting in New Zealand about how a number of investment projects or projects have been announced and not had business cases done, or been announced and committed to, but the business cases didn't necessarily demonstrate that. So there's been a need to, again, update a lot of the policies and processes and get the strengthening and the discipline back into decision making. And then, you know, the next kind of two pillars that are needed is the institutional structures and arrangements, which at the end of last year culminated in sort of some decisions and a lot of work done the 12 months beforehand in ensuring we had Infracom really focused on what they can only do, which is the strategy, long-term strategy, independent advice in terms of what is needed, where and when, a commercial capability to enable private sector engagement and investment in what they call NIFCO. And moving policy responsibilities back where policy responsibilities should be. So we've got the institutional arrangements sort of well-defined now. Governance and capability is kind of being completed to give them the strength that they need. They've got the mandates.
And some planning reforms
as well. And that's the last piece, right, is the planning reforms and making sure that that when you've made the decisions that you can actually get them implemented quickly.
So, and the one I think that we should be looking to New Zealand for guidance and leadership on, because that kind of planning molasses comes up regularly here as a thing that just it doesn't stop stuff, but it slows it so much that you lose the momentum.
Look, and I think there is that benefit, I suppose, of New Zealand being just the two tiers of government, and a lot of the legislative levers can sit quite centrally in the Crown, particularly for planning. And how they then, I mean, yes, local government does have planning responsibilities and levers themselves, but there's a real sort of primacy around what the Crown can do. Where I think in Australia, we've still got state primacy as well as some, national intentions and that can be slightly disconnected at time, and where money gets held.
The Conservative as well.
Yeah, correct.
But
certainly I think there is definitely lessons learned around how to.
I think we sometimes forget as well that local government is a product of state government.
Yeah.
So there are levers. It's just whether you have the political
correct
to be able to pull them.
Absolutely. Correct. Yeah. And I think the last piece that is needed to just strengthen the New Zealand opportunity is capability and broad capability.
Is that a perennial problem, just sort of size and geographic location of New Zealand, or is it something?
I think it is. It's a little bit of that. I think it's been also. It's also a little bit of the fact that the activity hasn't been there. And for such a long period of time. And as you know, we're in a global market competing for talent, and talent will go where there are opportunities. And so to be able to deliver on their ambitions, both the public sector and the private sector will need capability investment over the next 10 years or 15 years in New Zealand.
Sure.
And I think, Australia had the same challenge, maybe 15 years ago as well, particularly New South Wales. But it was fortunate that, I think this is the benefit of the states being the big procurers and the big service deliverers, is they actually had already had departments with good capability. Mm. And that it was a little bit more narrower in the type of capability that they needed. But we certainly had to attract, private sector industry here, construction companies here. And certainly in the heyday when we, had what I call the big five projects sort of really in different stages of momentum, we were, really struggling to ensure that we had the right capability in the private sector to lead these projects out and to engage. And so we were very fortunate to have this handful of really amazing people in New South Wales to lead some of these big projects.
Sorry, just on that point, New South Wales was also able to attract into the public service during that period, 2011, there, people like Peter Regan, yourself, retaining people like Rod Staples. They're just, I know good people attract good people. And do you have a sense of what that special sauce was that made those people say, actually, this is something I'm going to, commit to for 5 years? And
look, I think most people do, I believe, have a sense of service, right? And they do, even if you see it in the next generation, they think more about the world and think how they can contribute to making the world a better place than they think less about themselves. And so I think when you're given an opportunity to come into, a government environment and add some value and something that you think you can bring value to, it's amazing. But as I said, there was a lot of special ingredients. I think the government of the day between, Barry and Mike and Gladys, including the other ministers around, were just an inspiring bunch of ministers and premiers to work for.
Mm.
Which then culminated down into the CEs or the secretaries of the departments. The fact that they were very clear in terms of their priorities, and they lived in terms of ensuring that maintained their priorities, gave everyone that sense of confidence that this was real, you know. And then, as I said, you know, that we got the fortunate piece of a number of really great people to come in. And as you say, they just attract other great people. But it's not an easy environment to work in. I think, you know, we have had and I hear stories about private sector people coming into government environment and feeling, you know, the challenge of working in the environment of less direct conversations, more passive aggressive, you know, maybe not moving things as fast, you know, so and getting quite frustrated because they feel they've got a strong mandate from a minister, but the reality is it's the public service and how the public service works together that enables things to happen. And so you do have to kind of have a mind to how you work in the public service and coming in. And I think we're just fortunate that there was just so many people in that period that appreciated that, didn't have to have, you know, their ego stroked to kind of operate in that environment and really cared about getting things done. And an environment that enabled it.
I was actually going to ask something really similar, and I find it a really interesting point of advocacy that you really push to see more people come in from the private sector into government, and actually people from government get experience in the private sector. And I wondered if you could just elaborate on what you see as being the value in the projects you've led, or in the sort of innovation or diversity of thinking you've seen come out of the work you've done. You know, what's that sort of two-way value proposition?
Well, I think if you think about things more general in a sort of very high level, you know, government, if you think about government roles, I mean, one of their biggest and only roles that they can do is develop policy, right? You know, private sector is really great at making things happen and doing things. And I've always been a big believer is great policy is always informed by a mindset of that understands implementation. You know, there's no point in having great policies that's never going to be implemented, or having policies that can't be implemented. And I do think that walking and living on both sides means you get a better appreciation of why, as an implementer, things might take a little bit longer to develop the policy because of you understand the policy development process. But as a policy developer, understanding that if you make particular decisions or design a policy a particular way, how it can be better implemented and get the outcomes that you're looking for is really quite important. And I think I'm a big believer in empathy and walking in other people's shoes and how you take that into different roles that you play. So as I said, you know, my experience in Longreach always has stuck with me around decisions I make while I'm sitting at number one, the terrace, impact people on the ground in Whangarei or, you know, in Dunedin or something, and what that actually means. Because having worked as an implementer in an environment now where I'm, you know, providing advice on reform and policy, it's how that then becomes, you know, better policy or implementable reform.
Lani, as you know, the definition of an expert is someone from out of town with a different accent, and you now have developed a Kiwi twang. So I'm going to ask for your advice. Yeah, I'm saying yeah, but I don't know if that, we'll go with it. One of the dynamics that's happening now in Australia is a pretty precipitous decline in transport investment as the fiscal circumstances bite, and some of the kind of supply side investments are coming to fruition, so there's a bit of a relief in demand, but nevertheless the investment's going down. Do you have any advice for trying to reinvigorate that now, and what Australia can, some Australian jurisdictions could do to reinvigorate the transport pipeline and maybe make sure that it doesn't fall into a deep valley?
Yeah, look, it is quite sad to see that there is this decline here, and that, I mean, I do appreciate that, you know, infrastructure is cyclical, that we build for tomorrow, we don't build for today. But even, what is it, you know, 15 years on or 14 years on, you know, we're already seeing the light rail here is foolish. You know, yes, WestConnex is not quite full, but it's busy, getting busier. You know, particularly since I came in this morning on Victoria Road, and, you know, can see we're just moving congestion differently. So it's really sort of disappointing to see that what was established here in terms of thinking long-term and continual investment and making sure you keep doing the planning so that when you get your fiscal situation right, you can invest, but always be mindful that we need to keep creating that fiscal sort of envelope. And so it's as I said, it's quite disappointing to see that some of that discipline or way of thinking has been muted, I suppose. And I think this is where I suppose you've got to think, what are the institutions that can keep reminding not just politicians but citizens, right, that we kind of deserve better? And it's like people like yourselves, you know, where are the iBodies in Infrastructure Australia in terms of, you know, creating that? Because it will be a shame that we have another 10 years of lack of investment, lack of focus, and then we're sitting here in 10 years' time going, now we need to restart the fundamentals, we've got to get the fiscal right, we've got to get the institutions set up, got to get the planning in place, and then we take another, you know, 5-10 years to get the results from that. And we need to keep remembering. The
skills have gone to New Zealand.
Yeah, correct, correct. Although New Zealand would welcome them at the moment. Very welcome at the moment.
Although there has been a shift though, hasn't there, to energy, and it's a back to your old stomping ground really. Do you have any comments on what you're seeing in Australia in terms of that movement to decarbonise the grid and, you know, support renewable deployment?
Yeah, so I think it's one of those interesting, again, where you'll see sectors ebb and flow. And it's great to see the momentum has really shifted. Maybe it's shifted too quickly because, you know, how does the market and the public sector kind of, because if I feel a little bit there's still an element of building and flying the plane at the same time. I think it's better to have, that's a better problem to have than to have no investment and no vision for what we kind of need to shift from to a decarbonised future and or a more electrified future, given where transport or where cars are going and the need that we have in terms of AI or quantum and, you know, technology in our lives. So, but it's interesting, it took a lot of moons to align to get to where we are today. But I think there's still a bit to go before it can actually settle, and some of that does kind of require some courageous leadership, I think, at the state level to execute, because it's now moved to the states needing to make sure it gets delivered, right?
We could talk about the future of infrastructure all day, but we have come to the end of the time available. We always ask all of the guests the same final question, which is, what's your favourite sort of infrastructure and why?
Oh, I don't have any favourites.
Well, you have to pick one. It's the.
Or have you a favourite project, infrastructure project that you worked on?
Okay.
I reckon that's an unfair leg up. You've got to pick a title.
That is. I mean, this is.
I've evolved it.
Yes. Well, I mean, I can answer that question easier than I can answer what's my favourite type of infrastructure. But I guess, I do like the transport space because it touches and enables many communities, if that makes sense. So connection within and across communities is something that I really like about linear infrastructure. And probably in answering your second question, you know, the two projects for different reasons that I really enjoyed in New South Wales was the WestConnex project and light rail. I know that sounds a bit strange given we lived through light rail. But WestConnex, I found that it was a sort of a real interesting and innovative way that government chose to back the advice around how to make WestConnex happen, you know, and so backing owning a company that would then see through greenfield development and recycle and having all of that thinking done up front, I thought was really quite a special time to be involved in that project. And now to drive on it and go, you know, I had a little bit to do with that, it's been and fantastic, and to see it being realised through the sale of the stakes over the last few years. Light Rail for me was something where it showed that if you stay the course and have a vision for something that you really believe, like Gladys really believed in the Light Rail project and what a difference it was going to make for Sydney, that when it is delivered, it's realised, even though it was really a challenging time from the beginning to the end. And so it showed to me how it was important in infrastructure to just maintain and stay the course, but also to be very open with communities and businesses that sometimes infrastructure is hard and it's going to be disruptive and it's going to be difficult, but it is worth it in the end. And I speak to a lot of people who have been on the light rail who sit there and say, I can't believe that Sydney didn't have this sooner. And so that's really, really nice to hear after a lot of the pain that many of us collectively went through to ensure that it happened.
Mm. Well, on that optimistic bombshell, thank you very much for joining us on Inside Infrastructure.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.